I think we're going to start in 1 Peter this morning. 1 Peter chapter 3. It's really something that we can relate to. You know, it's the first Sunday of 2021. And I can already hear, I don't know if this is your experience, but when you're growing up and it's the first Sunday of a new year, there's always this really awesome message that they've thought up to kind of shoot straight for the new year. Doesn't matter whatever series they were on, they'd always break off for something to strengthen your faith, your life, your mind, your wealth, etc., etc. And I really think that's there to default because of the holidays, and they all sort of said the same thing when I was growing up. But upon reflection, I do realize that the beginning of the year is a great time to reflect. And so I've been doing a lot of that in 24 hours in the car. You do quite a bit of reflection. But you shouldn't reflect on just the past year in general, because that's a very poor way to judge how you're going to live the rest of this year. But rather reflect on your whole life. The short-sightedness of 1 year, again, is a poor standard on which to improve your life. But surprisingly enough, reflecting on this year actually did improve my life quite a bit. 2020 was definitely a year for the books. Not so much for what everyone went through, but just because how we blew everything out of proportion and how it taught us and kind of conditioned us to take one minor disaster and turn it into a major, catastrophically damaging, life-altering event. What made us do that? You know, in times past, we've had, and the media is particularly good about it, about taking one thing, selling it for a day, and then moving on to the next crisis. But instead, we've decided to take every crisis of 2020 and make it a huge event that was just not, and everything was not going to be the same ever and ever again. So what has caused us to do that? Well, to be honest with you, when I was on Facebook, there was a lot of memes, a lot of inspirational quotes. There was a lot of verses on there. But one verse, to my recollection, I never recalled anyone putting Romans 8:28 on there, where it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them who are called according to His purpose." And that's something in 2020 I think we all lost sight of amidst the disasters and amidst the huge life-altering events that we have all come to know so well. And shamefully enough, we were all looking at what could go on next, but what else could go wrong instead of what is going on. The memes were funny and the circumstances were almost unreal, but what is really what occupied your mind the entirety of the year? The beginning of 2020, we were all pretty optimistic, and it was a big year, and the church was going a good direction, and it still is. But what 2020 has effectively done is made everyone, not just us, but everyone, lose sight of what ultimately is important and what could be going on for the future year. I feel like we've all taken a step back instead of a step forward into what we should be thinking about. Today I'd like to look at a few things that we should keep on our minds during the coming year. And I got my first point wrote out, and it got pretty lengthy, so I don't know if it's going to be short or right on time, but I only got through one point today, so bear with me. But we're going to look at 1 Peter chapter 3. We're just going to read verses 8 and 9. Just some things that we ought to be very mindful of. And starting in verse 8, it says, "Finally, be ye all of one mind, having compassion one of another. Love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that you are thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing." Now, I'm not going to talk about being blessed for the year 2021. For all of you that were expecting an uplifting, good sermon for the start of 21 to help y'all live your best life now, I apologize in advance, but we're going to go ahead and get in on this. What we're going to talk about today is the mind, but more specifically, one-mindedness, if that's a real term. If it isn't, it is today, so bear with me. What is one-mindedness? What is it when you say you have one mind? And it's kind of a tricky subject because there's not really particularly a right way to answer it in the verbiage. But having one mind means that you all think with the same basic filter and same basic principles that guide your thoughts and your life. It's not that you like peanuts and I like peanuts, and so we can get along. That's not having one mind. Again, that's preference. But when it comes down to what guides your thoughts, what guides your thought process, what do you use to walk through life? What do you use to assimilate data into your everyday heart, life, and mind? This is particularly important for people of my age group, Anna's age group, and the younger people, but this also goes very deeply into what the older people pass on down to the younger generation and what they use even now. Are you using the right mindset? Do you need to change it? Is it something that you've been using wrong too long? And so on and so forth. But when you boil it down, it comes down to you have one mind or you are a double-minded person. But what does one have to do with the other? It says here in verse 8, be ye all of one mind. If you look through the Bible, there's two kinds of minds in the Bible. There's double-minded and there's one-minded. And there's no triple-minded, there's no quadruple-minded, there's no on and so forth. There's either one or the two. Because in the end, it's either option one or option two. Why call for one-mindedness? Why is that in the Bible? No matter what the generation is, this reminder is needed to remain centered. An interesting fact is that the phrase double-minded only turns up twice in the entire Bible. And then both of those are in the book of James. The importance of this is significant, and that is the difference between a firm foundation and the proverbial sinking sand. If you read in James 4:8, where this term comes up the second time, it says, draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Notice that in this verse it does not say purify your minds, ye double-minded. This direct association of the heart and the mind is also significant in that the first instruction in the book of 1 Peter, and it should be considered in many aspects. So, having one mind and being double-minded is not something that is reserved to one aspect of life, but it is one aspect that bleeds over into several aspects of life. The first one being individually. And this first one is particularly important. It's where everything starts. Notice, like we said before, that the Bible and Christianity is built on individuals, not so much groups of people. It is individuals that form a group of people that reflect one individual, which is Jesus Christ. We are not called to be such as other people, but we are all called to be like Christ. It's the individual that matters, and not so much us as a person, you know, our individuality, like we talked about. So individually, to have one mind, the purpose of that is so that we may be rooted and grounded in truth and not blown about with every wind of doctrine, as it says in Ephesians 4. So what does it mean to have one mind as an individual? And this is an open floor. You can totally tell me what you think.
The same goals.
That's a good one. And that is basically where you want to be. Having one mind as a person is more in the aspect of one-mindedness, and it kind of goes along with everything. Your one mind, where is your one mind? That's what I'm trying to get at here. Where is your one mind? As an individual.
An eye that's single.
An eye that is single. Where are you looking? How are you thinking? Because same goals, that's correct. In the views of marriage and church and everything else like that. But where it starts as an individual, where are you looking? Where are your thought processes coming from? What filters, what principles, who are you talking to?
Who do you believe?
Exactly. In the end, as an individual, you will think as you believe. And you will believe what you put in. The filter and the principles that you use to go through everyday life are used to form your character as an individual. And as the Bible says, your character ought to be developed through the character of Christ. So individually, this one mind reflects the one mind we all ought to have, which is the mind of Christ. Again, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. It's the goal of the individual to have the mind of Christ. Consequently, it's whatever, when two people get married, it's what mind they have in them determines the success they'll have in their married life. Because again, same goals, have to have one mind. So individually, to have the mind of Christ is to have the one mind that we ought to have to process all the information and the different information we get from the world, at our workplace, around, because you are influenced every day. I'm going to hammer on that a little more. Let me step away. It's going to be the influence you get every day at work, at school, on Facebook, on your phone, whatever, is processed one way or another. And whatever you bombard yourself with, because like it or not, you bombard yourself with stuff like that. Yeah. How that's all assimilated into you somehow, way, shape, or form. It's either put over here in the this is why this is wrong, and this furthers the reason why this is wrong. Or it says maybe this isn't so bad, and it goes into the reconsidering basket. There are three baskets, right, wrong, and reconsidering. A lot of people don't have that reconsidering basket, and there is no reconsideration. That's underrated. But a lot of people take that and say, well, this person's not so bad, they do it. I gotta reevaluate this. Because now we're slipping into people's opinion and how they do things and what they do and how they justify it. And we take away completely what Christ has dedicated to us through his word. As an individual, when you come across that one-mindedness, and I'm trying to make this super clear, Christ has put us aside for this mind because it's not difficult. And I'll tell you why it's not difficult. It's because he gave us everything we need in order to have it. It's not difficult because it's all laid out right here to those who will be open to the teachings of the mind you have. When sinners read the Bible, let me just lay it out flat. When sinners read the Bible, they will not understand because they are not seeking the mind of Christ. That's your major difference. That's how Joel Osteen can read it and say blessings, 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 because he's looking at it from an earthly perspective that perceives only material wealth. Mm-hmm. Whereas the mind of Christ knows that the riches are truly for your eternal life and life through him abundant. Not abundant in riches, but abundant in love, joy, peace, long-suffering, and all the fruit of the Spirit. The mind of Christ will look at this Bible and find peace, whereas the double-minded will look at it to find whatever they can gain. Again, reading it to see what they can get away with instead of what they're restricted to. Secondly, this one mind must be in marriage to preserve and uphold the godly imagery of the biblical marriage and home, which the world constantly tears down. This is important because now we're moving on from the individual and now we're looking to duality of one mind. And this is where everyone gets lost, because now you got two people with one mind and it doesn't make sense. It's like almost the wishbone where you break it in half and your wish comes true. You're kind of wondering where it all comes together, because that's what everybody wants. Everyone wants to have a peaceful marriage. Everyone wants to have a good relationship with their spouse. But all that doesn't come through duality of mind. If you go to a marriage counselor today, I've talked to a couple. Not personally, but I just, you know, I've sold cars. Let me just clarify. I've sold cars to people who are marriage counselors, and they have a degree, and they specialize in this sort of thing. And they tend to give advice unsolicited, particularly when you're waiting on a finance manager. So, if they notice that your wedding band is rubber, they wonder if you lost your wedding ring. And they say, well, that could be a sign of your devotion to your wife. Have you ever considered this book? And they continue to go on showing just signs. I'm like, well, actually, I got too fat and I grew out of my other ring, so I have another ring. That's... And when you put soap on it, it slides on and off. So, I mean, that's the reason. But you see, that's what they look for. They look for physical signs of devotion to your wife, because that's what they go to. They say, I see you work with a woman sitting behind you. How does that make you feel? And you're like, okay, I'm selling you a car. It's not really, you know, and they ask you all these questions. They probe your mind to see where your mental state is. And I'm like, they notice I don't have any pictures of my family on my desk. And I'm like, okay, settle down. You see, that's where it is. There's a duality of mind where they consider your mind in particular to see where you're at in your relationship with your wife. Secondly, compatibility tests. Everyone's always silent. How many people have taken a compatibility test with their spouse? Good.
Been doing it for 44 years.
If they ain't compatible at this point, just give up. Well, the world thrives on these compatibility tests and these algorithms that determine whether they are going to be compatible with their spouse. You can actually go in and say, hey, I get along really good with this person, but we better take a compatibility test to make sure we're going to be all right together. And if they take it and it's a thumbs down, well, then it's Splitsville. You know, we're just not going to do this. Because that's the way the world works. Again, they go off of dual mindsets. Their one mind that they're trying to find is somebody that melds and meshes with how they think, how they process. However, when you take Christ out of the equation, that's all they have. Their one-mindedness cannot come from someone who merely thinks like them. Because I can guarantee you there's not one person in the world that thinks like me, exactly. That thinks like her, that thinks like you. You won't find it. The divorce rate is through the roof because everyone expects to find that one perfect soulmate that thinks exactly like them. And when they find out that they don't, it's time to bail. You see, the picture of marriage that the Bible lays out and that the world tears down relies on a one mind in Christ in order for a marriage to survive. Because there is same goals, there are same principles, there are same filters, and there are same beliefs that are rooted and grounded in the Bible, not in how you've been raised, what you think, or what the preacher says. That's why it is comparatively important to find out what they believe as much as what soap they use and whether you think it smells good or not. That determines compatibility. If you don't like Irish Spring, you're out. Third, oh boy, don't get started on that. Third, this one mind in the church is almost the domino effect of what happens with the other 2 points we've discussed so far. The church represents the unity of Christ. So this should be a no-brainer as to why I say one-mindedness is essential in the church. It starts with the individual looking for the mind of Christ. It goes to the marriage where two individuals with the mind of Christ come together for the cause and the nurture of Christians and the church. And then the church is made up of all these people that in marriages that are supposed to have this one mind and supposed to have one mind being taught by the Bible and nothing more. What goes wrong is where we all bring these people in. They're Christian marriage counselors that operate the same way as that one I sold a car to and I have not spoken to since. You know, it goes on from there because they give you these books. They write these books. They tell you these ways to find out. They give you, and what I've learned in marriage is that marriage cannot be fixed or improved by a book or a series of actions laid out by a book. Because in the end, that is their idea of how to make a marriage better. When in the end, the only thing a marriage is supposed to represent is God in the church. And God doesn't, what's that book? They made a movie out of it.
Fireproof.
God doesn't do 30 things over 30 days to win the church over. Those are good principles to have in your marriage, but people use those books because they sincerely believe that their marriage will fail without them.
Yeah.
If they
fix it.
If they, yeah, mm-hmm. Or they look and, yeah. Again, it's a magic wand that the Christians have thrown out there that
love
God,
language.
Yes, love, yeah. Mm-hmm. But they put these things out there. You know what love languages is? A compatibility test.
That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay? Can we agree on that?
Yeah.
Because it tells you that your love language is compatible with this one. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, will you take this test? You get down on one knee and hand him a Gary, what's his name book? Take this test first before I propose here. Just want to make sure. Make sure it's the Lord's leading, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But see, that's where everything, they toss the mind out and they follow these other people's minds, which is duality of mind. Because like it or not, that book is not the mind of Christ. Compatibility tests are not the mind of Christ. Say it with me. Everyone listening, it is not the mind of Christ.
It's carnality.
It is carnality in, what is that word? Ecclesiastes, vanity of mind.
Humanism. Yes.
Very much.
Humanism.
It is becoming more in tune with your individuality, which further carries over into a selfish marriage. Mm-hmm. So anyone who has built their marriage on those books that is listening, I sincerely apologize that you've been wrong this long. The concept of this internal duality has been bred for longer than most people realize. And in an effort to protect the younger generation, we've effectively buried our head in the sand to the sin of, quote-unquote, making it work. Bringing you to the ultimate climax of what this dual-minded is, and at the root of it is the word compromise. Again, many marriage counselors will tell you that marriage is about
compromise.
Yes. Marriage is about letting her do some things you don't like, and she lets you do some things that she does not like. 50-50, you put in some, you give a little, I give a little, and that's how marriage works. And I can tell you, that's how marriage doesn't work. That's how marriage divorces. Because it's duality of mind. It is dual-mindedness. It's saying, I don't like this, but you can do it. Giving her further permission, well, he doesn't like this, but he lets me do this, so I will go ahead and do this. Ultimately, turn it around, she doesn't like this, but I'm doing it anyway, because 50-50. Yep. In the church, the preacher says we shouldn't do this because of the Bible, but you know, my marriage works like this, so now me and Christ are going to work like this. He doesn't like it, but I'll give a little extra in the offering. Make you feel a little better?
Balance things.
Yeah. I'll tithe my stimulus check. How's that? You know, the Lord giveth, you know. It's the same thing. It's duality of mind. The root cause of this sin that has been rampant for far too long, and one that goes by many names, is the sin of compromise. You can find nowhere in the Bible where God compromises with man on something he said not to do. But you can find plenty of times in the Bible where man compromised on what God told him to do and were further punished. So what makes us think that's any different in the modern day? He talked about being progressive in getting the gospel out there and how you have church and all that. I agree with that. But everyone else takes that progressiveness. That's progressing, not progressiveness. You see the difference there? There's progressing because you have to stay with the times. But you can't be progressive and stay with the times. You know what I mean? There are two completely different meanings there that is not working. In the age of the debating Christianity, there's far too much of this right here. Individuals, marriages, and churches all thrive on their ability to make peace, get along, and resolve issues from generations past. When in reality, we've created nothing but excuses and weakened grounds on which we stand. And here's where we're at now. We talk of militant Christianity in spiritual world, and they take it physical because, again, no mind of Christ. When you take the mind of Christ out of there, any insight to the spiritual world is limited to magic and demons. Because that's all the world perceives, and that's all the world puts out there. And wishy-washy angels ringing bells to get wings. Great movie, terrible principle. Militant Christianity is now perceived as an impossible position to take, to have, and to keep. The decision to compromise is about the impact in the long run because of a short-run consequence. Think about it with me. Macroeconomics, we have short-run and long-run effects of the economy. And there's a whole book about that thick that I never read for school that tells me all about these principles. However, I passed the class. But it's all based on long-run and short-run principles. It's about making a decision now to end the short-run consequence, but keeping in mind the long-run fix, such as this pandemic. Take it, for instance. I wrote a big, long 12-page paper on this. The short-run consequence of this pandemic is a ruined economy. The short-run consequence of handing out stimulus checks, or short-run fix, is that everyone has money put back into the economy. The long-run consequence is the further deficit we have in the national budget.
Yep.
And see, no one knows where that money's coming or going or where we're going to get it to pay it back. So the long-run consequence is an economic crash by the year 2026. However, because the people don't look beyond, and this has been taught by economists for all year now, is that the long-run consequence is a possible economic crash worse than 2008 recession in 2026. But right now, people need relief because we're out of a job, so here comes two more stimulus checks, potentially. However, that furthers the long-run consequence of a 2025 recession because of the bigger stimulus checks that are being proposed. But do we care? The answer is no, because we're going to vote and pass the stimulus checks to get the people the relief to pay off whoever we need to pay off so they can be back in a job and make more money into the economy, mm-hmm. voting it from a short-run perspective. It's been the same in churches for a long time. We want people in the church, and so we find a way to get people in the church. The short-run consequence is that we're compromising on principles that we've stood firm on for so long that people now perceive that we've backed off them. It's like when you take a dump truck and you dig out a piece of land. The land behind it becomes further weakened, and when you stand on the edge of it, it will crumble and break, furthering the pushback of anything that comes to happen. Is that making any sense? The long-run consequence is that we have now no firm ground to stand on because our credibility is completely removed from the short-run vote to end these principles to get more people in the church. So what's the solution? Now our Christian economists have decided that a long-run solution is to pull back on standards and to pull back on this and pull back on that and find biblical reasons why it's okay to pull back on it, trying to build more ground to stand on. The domino effect of compromise is that you have no more ground to stand on.
Right.
And the dominoes named compromise keep falling. Because once you compromise on one thing, just like I was telling you the other day, everything relies on one another. If you pull one thing out, then the whole thing crumbles down. Because the Bible builds on itself. The principles of the Bible keep each other together. And when you remove one, none of them make sense. Which is the horrible concoction of the Baptist faith. Is that we have messed up, for instance, the doctrine of original sin. We have put that in there and rested the scriptures to make it work. But the furtherance of the rest of the principles of the gospel are now completely null and void, making the gospel less effective, meaning we now have to compromise and make it an easier gospel, or explain it a different way, or save them a different way, or baptize them a different way, in order for my original sin to work.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so now every principle has been torn down to the point where we now build a false principle on true precepts. And we all know that even a building built on sand will not stand. The proverbial sand of original sin has completely ground zero, scorched earth, every other principle that is in the gospel of the saving mercy of Christ.
Yep.
And I don't think people see that as well.
No.
Because it's been such a commonplace issue for now that we all just push it aside in the name of getting along. But how can you have fellowship with two salvation plans where one is built on a totally false principle?
Mm. Yeah. Nope, you can't.
Nope.
No, the two cannot walk together lest they be agreed. Mm. Not two can walk together if they compromise just a little bit. Mm. Compromise is the definition of double-mindedness.
Yes.
This is not what we do, but they can and will get along. You tell your kids, you know, they do this, but you know, we get along with them. There's a difference between being acquaintances, family, and friends. There is a difference. And it's really hard to be friends with people who don't believe the way you do or adhere to the principles that you do, because there will always be enmity in those subjects. Because one, the mind of Christ will not gel with a double-minded person, because it's a single mind. So really the question today is, where is your mindset? Do you have the long-run effect of double-mindedness, Or do you have the eternal mindset of one mind, the mind of Christ, that we are commanded to have? So my uplifting message to start 2021 is, where is your mindset? Is it still back in 2020 where it's going to be one disaster after another, and you know what? Whatever. I believe 2020 is being portrayed as making us all more thankful for what we have, but in the end, it made us grumblers. It made us entitled. It has made us totally unthankful as a people.
Divisions.
And it has divided deeper than anyone could ever know.
Yes.
The mind of Christ went totally out the window.
Yes.
And whatever the government told us, I mean, that was just how it was. In many churches, they never recovered. And there is no recovery because they never truly had the mind of Christ. Again, that one doctrine we talked about takes you totally out of touch with the rest of the gospel, which takes you out of touch with Jesus Christ.
Yes, sure does.
So how can you filter through Christ and have a true relationship with Christ when you believe that you're a sinner and you glorify and worship the fact that you are still a sinner saved by grace?
Yeah, you can't.
You can't. There is no...
Right there.
Think about it. Think about it. Think about it. That two-man gospel. Two-man, two minds, double-mindedness. I don't mean to be Alex Jones about it, but that's the way it is. It's, they have their gospel is dual-mindedness. And that will not stand, because in the Bible we are blatantly told to have the mind of Christ. One mind, as an individual, in our marriage, and as a church. Bleeds over into every aspect of your life. Where do you dump your one mind off? Do you live single-minded or double-minded?